Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Kevin, its Western backers got some truly bad news last week. Amnesty International says Ukraine's fighting tactics endanger civilians. Zelensky and his gang are not the innocent victims, media claim. Plus, we hear a lot about a big offensive soon. Well, will it be Ukrainian or Russian? Discuss these issues and more. I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we have Dmitry Babich. He's a political analyst and editor at InnoSme Internet Media Project. Our gentleman, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, start out in Budapest. George, the Kiev government was very disappointed with Amnesty International's report. And claiming that the tactics that the Ukrainian army is using is violating the rules of law of war and could be potentially deemed as war crimes. And then Amnesty International fought back and said, you know, after all of the criticism, because if you criticize the Kiev government, it's you're akin to being an apologist, a racist, transphobe, just about anything you could imagine. Okay, it's just off limits here, but. If you've been following independent media, the claims that Amnesty International has made, we've known this from day one. It's not a surprise whatsoever. What is a surprise is that a Western NGO would have the courage to actually say the truth. Your thoughts?
Oh, that's absolutely right. But the war in Ukraine has been a liberals' war, which means that not only do we have on one side fascist Hitler and the Hitler's victims, but you have absolute evil on one side, absolute good on the other. And of course, one side is the victim of an unjustified and unprovoked, always have to say, it's
always unprovoked.
Yeah. It's always unprovoked attack. And so when Amnesty comes along and says, as you say, Peter, that stuff that we had known from the start, which is that the Ukrainian forces have been using as military bases, schools and hospitals, then that, of course, calls this whole equation into question. So that's why the most furious onslaught has come from liberal media outlets such as The Guardian, which naturally, you know, highlight all these stories from Ukrainian government officials, including Zelensky himself, and of course, American and British government officials. This is absolute nonsense. This is a very poorly researched report. The Amnesty people on the ground know absolutely nothing. But they're saying what we've known all along. They're using schools and hospitals for what reason? In order to draw retaliatory fire. And why do they want to draw retaliatory fire? So that they can then point to Russians as committing war crimes. And of course, the media and the Western government officials have played along with that, repeating ad nauseum that the Russians are committing war crimes. When we know that they deliberately, I mean, this is what Amnesty says, they deliberately, there are plenty of other places where they could have had military bases. Instead, they went to a school. When that school was destroyed, they moved it to another school. So, and when one hospital is destroyed, they move to another hospital. So that's been their tactic. These are the places where they want to locate their forces. So naturally, when this equation of Russians are absolute evil and Ukrainians are absolute good is shattered, then you know there's all hell breaks loose.
You know, Dima, with every passing day, the reality is infringing upon the propaganda. This is the most propagandistic war we've ever seen in our lifetime. I thought Iraq was bad, but this is much worse. And so just when the curtains pulled back, you see a very different reality. And that's why these people, their hair gets on fire because you're not supposed to say this. You're not supposed to even think these kinds of things here. But it's like I've said, and what George has said here, is that this has been very well documented if you really want to know. Amnesty International didn't just come across something unusual. It came across something that's very commonplace, unfortunately. Go ahead, Dima.
This is the most frustrating thing about it all. The Russian media and, the local media in Donbas, they have been reporting about this thousands of times, during the fighting in Mariupol, during the fighting in Severodonetsk. they always, the Ukrainian forces keep using kindergartens and schools for their military bases. And there was plenty of footage. And there was zero attention paid to that in the West. So for me, the most frightening thing is that if you want to attract attention to your death or to the risks for your life, you have to go to these hypocrites, because I consider these people hypocrites. You know, I saw their press conferences in Moscow in the 90s, in the 2000s, in 2010s. To be frank with you, you know, the language used by Amnesty International about the war in Chechnya, about the war in Yugoslavia was very hypocritical. I mean, I don't like these people. I hate their pigeon language that they use, but they are the only ones who can attract attention. The West just doesn't believe any other organizations. The West doesn't believe its opponents. So the only way you can attract attention is by going to these people. And this is not the first time. You know, Human Rights Watch in 2014 reported the use of cluster munitions by the Ukrainian forces. I'm quoting, you know, 2014. Ukrainian government forces used cluster munitions. This is from Human Rights Watch. This is against the laws of war and may amount to war crimes. This was documented at least 14 times in Donetsk. This was documented by the International Committee of the Red Cross, who was killed in October 2014 during an attack on Donetsk with the use of cluster munitions. So I remember when this report came out, how the Western media tried to hush it up. You know, of course, you know, people in Donetsk were very enthusiastic about it because, Jesus, for the first time, the Western media is telling now about our suffering. And immediately there was a lot of criticism. And as usual, Human Rights Watch, just like Amnesty International, had to balance it, you know, with lots of reports on, you know, war crimes committed by the other side. So, I mean, for me, the most frustrating thing is that this is something obvious, something that you don't have to be a specialist to see. You see it everywhere in Eastern Ukraine. And only when Amnesty International finally reports it, there is some attention paid, and Mr. Zelensky gets angry. And the head of the Amnesty International's Ukrainian bureau, Oksana Pakalchuk, suddenly leaves, saying that her values cracked up to be different from the Amnesty International values.
They have shown something
about themselves, and immediately she has to resign because, Jesus, they can notice the suffering of Russian speakers. Oh, thank God, you know.
You know, George, I mean, I guess it's kind of an interesting juxtaposition, you know, being on the cover of Vogue magazine and Amnesty International. I guess you kind of get your pick, as it were, here. But that's just the point, you know, isn't it? I mean, it's not, you know, the suffering of the people. And all people suffer on the ground during wars, okay? Let's be honest about that, okay? But, I mean, this Western media propaganda pitch, you know, I mean, how many times have, you know, we've seen situations like this that they make it on the cover of Vogue magazine? I mean, they're really scraping the bottom of the barrel, aren't they?
Well, they definitely are. And that, of course, didn't do Zelensky any good at all, because that was even too much for Zelensky's biggest fans. But going back to this, these international humanitarian organizations, they are part of the Western propaganda machine, because they are there to demonize the foe of the day, you know, whether it's Saddam Hussein. In the 90s, it was, you know, it was Milosevic. Then as
Gaddafi.
Yeah, Gaddafi.
Hitler. It's always
The Russians in Chechnya. That's what they're there to do. They write these reports to tell them these people are absolute monsters. They commit war crimes. And if you look at how these organizations fund themselves, they, a lot of very wealthy people and foundations, George Soros and others, you know, give them huge amounts of money. I mean, these are lavishly funded organizations. The people who are on the boards of these organizations, they're all former politicians, former government officials, former intelligence agents, and And, you know, this is part of their enormous reputation. But occasionally, they want to balance things. And so, for let's say 10 reports that Human Rights Watch publishes about the horrors that the Russians have perpetrated, once they might say something about negative about what the Ukrainians are doing. Just 10 versus 1. But even that one publication, and all all hell breaks loose, and then there's an immediate attack. Saying, you know, well, this is, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. You're drawing equivalence between aggressors and victims. And what often happens, they immediately have to start backing away. Now, so far, Amnesty International, which is run by this Agnès Kayemat, hasn't done so. And she does have a certain reputation because she was the person who wrote that report about the U.S. assassination of Iranian General Soleimani. And she said that was essentially a war crime. So she hasn't backed away as yet, but I think there will be further repercussions within Amnesty. I think they
We'll keep an eye on it. You know, Dima, there was a lonely call in the woods about, why don't we investigate Ukraine's oligarchs? Again, everyone, you know, runs in shivering, you know, oh, no, you can't do that, you know, because, you know, we still have more and more money being poured in. We don't know where it's going. Nobody really knows where it's going. We don't know who has all the SWIFT codes and all of that, but it seems to be disappearing. I mean, but no investigation of people that have known criminal histories. Go ahead, Dima.
Well, again, here you have this duplicitous use of language. Why don't we investigate Ukrainian oligarchs? Why don't you investigate American oligarchs? You know, the word oligarch it became a fetish. If you don't like someone who is rich, you call him an oligarch, right? And this is the only way this machine can operate in the West.
Well, I mean, David, these people are very rich and they're very unlikable, but they can work together. Keep going.
Exactly. It reminds me of Stalin's Soviet Union. Someone who yesterday was a respected party official like Nikolai Bukharin, tomorrow, because the papers call him a deviationist, you know, a leftist deviationist or a rightist deviationist, suddenly he becomes a criminal and anything can be used against him, you know. The same story here. And when George said, this is 10 to 1, it's not even 10 to 1, it's 100 to 1. And still, these people cannot tolerate any criticism of Ukraine. Again, it reminds me of the times of the Soviet Union and not in favor of today's West, because look, in 1962, a Soviet magazine, Novy Mir, published this prose work by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. And immediately, you know, why did people believe, people only then believed in Stalin's repressions? Because, look, the Soviet Soviet magazine, the Soviet literature is telling us about it. So it must be true. The same story here.
Heartbreak, and after that heartbreak, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with our team.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the home edition. To remind you, we're discussing some real news.
Okay, let's go back to Budapest. George, let's change gears a little bit here. We've heard through official medium, corporate media, that the Ukrainians claiming they're getting a 1 million man army together and there's going to be a big offensive. I think there may be an offensive this month. I just tend to doubt if it's going to be the Ukrainian one. But I have a theory about it, and it's kind of on a tail end of what we said in the first part of the program. This is actually a fundraising event. This is they're fundraising, you know, we're going to get an offensive together, you know, and we need support. We need money, more money. That's what it is. It seems to me that's kind of like a PowerPoint presentation, you know, this offensive, because from what I can tell, correct me if I'm wrong, they haven't really had one significant strategic tactical victory in all of this. Go ahead, George.
Yes, I agree completely. I mean, I think that the Ukrainians are, the Kiev government are essentially trying to get more and more money out of the United States. And they're doing it by going on about how they're going to mount this huge offensive in Kherson. And it's something that works because right away the media report this and they talk about, well, the upcoming offensive. But of course, if you really are planning an offensive, the one thing you don't do is you don't publicize it. You don't tell your opponents that you're about to attack them and then get them to move their forces and be ready for your offensive. I mean, that makes absolutely no military sense whatsoever. Yet the media reports seriously, yes, this upcoming offensive in Kherson, and then once the Russians are defeated there, then the whole campaign will be in tatters. And sure enough, Biden has just announced another $1 billion worth of arms and ammunition.
For the offensive.
and that's, they need to maintain this stance that they're somehow on the brink of winning this war, because otherwise the Americans and everyone else are going to start asking questions. Where is this going? How long can we go on essentially depleting our own armories? You're sending them weapons. We don't know what's happening to these weapons. They don't seem to be any good because, you know, the moment we send $1 billion worth of weapons, suddenly we need another $1 billion. I mean, what is happening? So they have to keep doing this in order to keep this channel going indefinitely.
You know, Dima, the giving money seems to be an excuse for everything, okay? Money will solve everything. But considering over the past few months the amount of Western arms and monetary aid, it hasn't had any impact whatsoever. So throw more money at it. This is something that is really hard to comprehend. I personally think, this is my own personal opinion, is that the Kiev regime, they're just trying to see if they can get as much as they possibly can before they have their moment of reckoning, okay? I make reference to the Afghan president when his helicopter is leaving the country. You get my point. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, I think this is a disastrous situation when we have an uncontrolled flow of money, corrupt officials in Ukraine, and we have people in the United States who basically failed with all of their predictions, but who are still in charge of sending weapons and money. You know, just last week, the German press reminded us of Mark Milley, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Just 2 weeks before the Russian special operation began, he predicted that there would be a war. It would last for 72 hours. The Russians would take Kyiv in 72 hours. And then there would be a long, protracted guerrilla fight. You know, everything happened 100% differently. You know, the Ukrainian army was not a paper tiger, is not a paper tiger. It continues to fight. But there is no guerrilla war on the territory that Russia controls for a very simple reason. The Ukrainian army is fighting so well precisely because of the cruelty of the regime. If you don't go to the army, you get arrested, you go to prison. If you say something against the government now, you know, look, a member of the negotiating team of Ukraine was basically assassinated, shot dead by the Ukrainian security forces on the suspicion of betrayal. So basically, this is a very cruel regime. The army fights on the territories which this regime controls. When this regime leaves, like on the territory of Donbas, on the territory of Zaporozhye, on the territory of Kherson, people live completely different life and try to forget, about this regime. They're only afraid that it would come back. You know, that's true. They're afraid that it would come back. But there is no guerrilla war. It's not Afghanistan. You know, the problem with the United States is that it fights wars. It starts wars in so many parts of the world that finally these people get confused. You know, they confuse Afghanistan for Ukraine, Yugoslavia for Vietnam, and other things. So, but answering your question,
they plan all of these wars from the same air-conditioned office in a suburb.
Exactly.
Exactly. The only thing they have in common.
That's a sad reality. Yes, basically what is really dangerous, it's not just the loss of money, it's the danger of escalation. And in that sense, there was a pretty interesting article in The Economist last week, which was headlined, "What Would Push the West and Russia to Nuclear War?" And basically the journalist there he saw the change in attitudes of the United States. You know, when all of the predictions failed and obviously it became a war of two armies, suddenly the United States reviewed its position. And starting from April, they started sending very dangerous weapons, right? In since June, the position is not to let Ukraine lose. We're not going to, we don't want Ukraine to win because obviously the goals which Zelensky stated are not realistic. He wants all the territory back and he speaks about striking at Russia. The United States says, oh, we don't support that, but we don't want Ukraine to lose. That's a very broad definition. I mean, they accuse Putin of...
That's not a military strategy. That's a political... Yeah.
And it's not a political strategy neither. So the article in The Economist ends with a very good quote that I would use here. They quote Tom Schelling, an economist, who said that plunging into war is not a sharp edge of a cliff where one can stand firmly, look down, and decide whether or not to plunge. Rather, it's a slippery slope, and no one can be sure when the risk is the greatest. You just slide down without noticing how you slide down.
Well, that's
escalation, you know, into basically a war between Russia and NATO.
Okay, well, that's this, you know, thoroughly modern Milley in his, you know, he has his other issues, okay? I suppose he would want to fight a woke war. You know, George, everyone knows that Ukraine for a while has been pushing to get into NATO. It's part of their constitution, after all. And then, you know, after the conflict started, they made a desperate attempt to get into the EU. But on both accounts, you know, irrespective of the conflict, you know, the biggest strike against Ukraine was corruption. But suddenly that strike is not meaningful. OK. And that's why it seems to me this is an amazing grift, a con job that the West is more than willing to go along with at the expense of their own people. You cannot. If you go in mainstream media, you cannot. It'll hit you in the face. Energy security in Europe, food security around the globe, and because this is this kind of mirage of what they want to have. It's literally a mirage, and it's going to face so many people around the world, particularly in Europe, on energy in a very, very sober, hard way, and very, very soon, George.
Yeah, no, it is a remarkable fact. It's, as you said, it's at the expense of their own people, because nowhere in Europe or in the United States have the people spoken out in favor of getting involved in Ukraine. There's absolutely no support for this. I mean, they've done these polls, and in none of the polls is there any interest at all in getting involved in Ukraine. So this is entirely a war waged by elites whose lives are very comfortable. They're very well remunerated. They go to very nice parties and conferences where they, you know, lavishly entertained. They want to continue this. And when you ask them, yes, but what about food shortages? What about energy shortages? What's going to happen this winter? Said, well, the price of freedom, you know, is something that we have to pay. You know, freedom isn't free, I think Biden has said. So they're happy to sacrifice others, just as they're happy to sacrifice Ukrainians for a war that they cannot win. So they're happy to sacrifice their own public for a protracted conflict in which the public is impoverished. And when somebody comes along to challenge this, like as Viktor Orban has, and again, he's only challenged it in a very mild way. He's gone along with NATO and the EU on sanctions and condemnations of Russia. But he does say, hey, we've got to think about ourselves a little bit more. He's immediately under attack. And you know, we will wait for what's going to happen in Italy, because I think it's quite likely that kind of Italian populist right will come to power sometime in September. And it will come under ferocious attack. I mean, there'll be we'll be hearing all about illicit payments, some scandals, what happened 5 years ago. Oh, exactly, all the stuff that we know. So, how dare you break the consensus that this war has to be fought indefinitely?
But Dima, we're rapidly running out of time. But Erdogan of Turkey, he's the one that says, you know, they're turning himself into the kingmaker. I mean, everyone's going to Erdogan right now. Because he's a member of NATO, an aspirant for the EU, and he's just flaunting all of his quote-unquote allies. I mean, he had a very lengthy trip in Sochi, came out smiling and is making himself a broker here. And so again, challenging the united consensus against Russia. It's propaganda. Finish it up, Dima, 45 seconds.
Well, yes. I mean, Erdogan morally is not a very good character. Certainly, he is not, as we say in Russia, a hero of my romance. He is a pragmatic person. And in the world ruled by a cruel ideology that is ready to sacrifice Europeans, not only people of poorer areas in the world, but Europeans are suffering from their politics now. And these people are ready to sacrifice them. In this world, Erdogan, as a pragmatist, suddenly stands out positively. He is better than these so-called moral people in the EU.
And that's what it takes, these kind of conflicts here. You see who's ideological and who's not, who's pragmatic, and what policies work and policies that don't work. And in the West,
he gets things done, with
terrible awakening here. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and here in Moscow. And I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT's. Remember, cross-talk rules.